session. Chief Judge Frisch, Judge Smith, Judge Bradfield, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated, everyone. Good morning, or good afternoon, I should say. It's unusual to have an afternoon argument. All right, we're here on A24-1936, In Re Calm Waters Cannabis Company petitioner. Council, you're familiar with our proceedings. You'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument. The petitioner has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. I'd ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking and let us know how we can reference you this afternoon. And whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Alethea Heiser from Frederickson and Byron, and I am appearing today on behalf of the petitioners, which is a fairly long list of individuals, so I'm going to call them petitioners. We thank you for your time and attention today. The case before you this afternoon is unique in a couple of important ways. In addition to us being here in the afternoon, it is a writ of prohibition, and it is a proceeding in which the parties arguing before you don't have a lot of material dispute. The fundamental question presented by the writ is whether or not a stay entered by the Ramsey County District Court on November 25th, 2024, lacked jurisdiction. And both petitioners and respondent OCM will tell you that the court did lack jurisdiction. And in fact, the district court itself questioned its own jurisdiction and appears to have made essentially a decision to enter an order that would temporarily just sort of halt things so that this court could in fact exercise proper jurisdiction over the cases at issue. We therefore ask the court to finalize the temporary writ and determined that the court's order lacked jurisdiction and therefore is legally essentially void and null.
So counsel, in our order establishing this, originated at special term, and in our order establishing a briefing schedule and asking you to come in today for further argument, we wanted you to address two primary issues. One is the mootness doctrine, and we can get to that. But also we wanted to have you address, and I'll pose the same question to the respondents, whether the district court had subject matter jurisdiction with respect to each asserted claim in the four separately filed actions. And I didn't see that in your brief. So can you address subject matter jurisdiction as it relates to each of the four actions?
Sure, and I'm going to have my colleague here pull up each of those actions for me.
And maybe to orient you, I'll phrase it this way. It seems to me that in the majority of the actions, there are two types of claims. One are objections to the department's ruling on the petitions, and then there's an objection to the process that may or may not have complied with the statutory obligations. It may be that subject matter jurisdiction is exclusive. There's exclusive certiorari jurisdiction in the former, but perhaps not in the latter. And I think the clock needs to be going.
It does. Yeah, I'm happy to respond to that because I think when we look at, I did look at Zweber, when we look at Zweber, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, but at Zweber, the distinction between quasi-judicial and legislative, right, is fundamentally looking at, was this a sort of broad decision that affects the general public? And alternately, are we fundamentally questioning the agency's quasi-judicial decision-making in bringing this action? Those are kind of the factors Weber is looking at. And here, there is a process that was created by statute. I don't understand the process arguments to actually be the arguments that fundamentally result in the stay, right? The stay is about the quasi-judicial. It's about the lottery and whether or not applicants are qualified or not.
But if the office isn't using the statutorily prescribed process to determine whether the applicants are qualified, isn't that a quasi-judicial? I mean, is that a legislative function?
I think that is a quasi-judicial function. I mean, I think that is your standard agency appeal situation. And I say this, I'm going to harken back. I used to work at the Attorney General's office. I've defended state agencies, so I'm going to step a little bit on my colleague's toes here. But it is very common in quasi-judicial decision-making for the agency to be evaluating facts and evaluating applications, applying that to a legislatively or rule, you know, legislative determined process. And if the question is fundamentally whether or not they got that decision right or wrong, including errors potentially in applying legal standards or following legal standards, those are standard writ of certiorari quasi-judicial appeals.
But if they're doing it over and over again and it's affecting the rights of many, why isn't that a legislative function?
Because you're fundamentally questioning their discretionary application of those standards.
But is it discretionary if they're not complying with the statutorily prescribed process?
Well, if it's a... There can be situations where there is a must, right? And there's an argument that it is... Why am I blanking on the word right now? But when there's a must, when there's a requirement, and that is there no, there you know thereafter not no longer discretionary. And I am counsel in a writ of mandamus pending, and making that argument right now. I think when you look at the fundamental arguments that were being made in front of the court. In Ramsey County on that date, those arguments really were fundamentally, we should be qualified applicants. We as individuals our applications were denied and we want to challenge that. That's what they were asking. That's what they were challenging. That was the only claim that got them the relief they were seeking, which is to be included in the lottery. And so the question and I think the decision, the reason the court was fundamentally uncomfortable with its jurisdiction is because those claims are classic quasi-judicial claims.
Can I ask this? Because I was struggling, but I might have come to a different conclusion than you about what Swaber means when I was reading it. Because I know it opens with a discussion of legislative versus quasi-judicial. But as I read... the opinion, it says, even for essentially, it says, essentially, even if it were a quasi-judicial decision, something that, you know, at its essence, the validity of the decision is a quasi-judicial, I mean, if you need to look at the, well, it is a quasi-judicial decision. If you need to look at the validity of it, it belongs in certiorari review. That it didn't, I don't see the Supreme Court deciding that what it said could go to the district court is a legislative decision. I don't think the answer is there a quasi-judicial decision here? I think the question that Swaber says, because it even ends with, accordingly, the county's objection does not change our conclusion that regardless of whether the county's decisions on the plat and the subdivision applications were legislative or quasi-judicial, the district court has jurisdiction to adjudicate Swaber's constitutional claims. It seemed to recognize that these are quasi-judicial decisions, because I was thinking, did it confuse matters by talking about legislative at all? Because we're in quasi-judicial land, and the question is, someone's challenge to a decision require an inquiry into the validity of that quasi-judicial decision, or is it something else?
And, I mean, Swaber involved a takings claim in 1983. Claims. I mean, those are classic district court cases, right? Classic district court claims. And Swaber, I think, you know, they acknowledge that the plaintiffs in that particular case, their takings claim presumed the validity of the agency's action. That for the purposes of their takings claim, they didn't need to challenge it. Their claim was, even if that's correct, we prevail because this is a takings. And their constitutional claims, certainly that, you know, those, you know, the constitutional claims can come up within the scope of a certiorari claim. They can be presented through 1983. I don't think we have a case that's on all fours with that here, right?
But
because
isn't it,
it's
conceivable, though. Let's leave aside these complaints, which is why I think it's helpful, and I think we asked for, let's go claim by claim in each of the complaints at issue, because let's just posit an idea where there is a process. You know, you have to have your application in by this date. Let's posit an idea where you get some notice or some fairness of notice or something, and instead it's all done in secret. You're excluded. You're never told why. Like some, like, wild, like, divergence from a process. Why wouldn't the challenge to the process, even if you're not looking at the invalidity of the actual decision, the validity of the actual decision, why would that not be under the unders waiver, something that could be brought in district court to compel, for example, compliance with the process, irrespective of what the decision will be, that you have to comply with the process?
Right, and I do, that's a distinction that I think matters here, because the relief sought in the lower court was, we want to be deemed qualified applicants. It was not, we want a process fixed, right? Our writ of mandamus right now that's pending is, they must run a process. Not how they run the process, not when they run the process. They must run a process. That is general, right? And that is, I think, a classic mandamus challenge. When we look at what the underlying plaintiffs here were seeking, they were seeking to be included. So it wasn't run the process. It was include me in the process. And that is what renders it really fundamentally quasi-judicial.
I mean, that may be the actual result that your clients want or the petitioners want, but the way to get there, I think, is the process is litigation over whether the process that was used or that is continuing to be used is compliant with the statute. And I mean, there are four cases here. I mean, it does seem to be that the process that's being used is affecting more than the rights of just them, but the rights of many.
Well, I think,
which seems quite, you know, legislative in nature.
So I would say four out of thousands of applicants.
Is there a distinction between what's going on with these four and the thousands of applicants?
I mean, yes, I think there. I mean, I guess I would leave that to my. I don't have an insight into OCM's decision making, but obviously my clients went through the process, were found to be qualified. They think the process was, I mean, for as it applies, they think the process was followed, and they just want to see the lottery proceed.
Let me ask this a different way. So we're, you know, you're asking us to say that this is, you know, there's no subject matter jurisdiction in the district court, and that the Court of Appeals must accept certiorari jurisdiction over all of these claims, which would include ostensibly some litigation over the validity of the process, which would require some findings of fact or conclusions of law about what that process is, how that process has unfolded, et cetera. How are we in the position that we are in as an appellate court to develop that record and make that decision when it involves some findings that are typically generated based on a record that's presented to a district court?
You know, I think respectfully, the problem that you're running into is that the legislature actually didn't provide a review process for this particular type of lottery and appeal. And
You do believe that the denials are reviewable by certiorari, right?
I defer to others. I just don't have an interest in that particular question because my clients were.
So I understood you to be saying that this shouldn't be reviewed entirely by certiorari. That's not your position?
Well, my position is if there's a review, it must be a certiorari review.
Got it. Okay,
but there is a law that says that there is no review. And normally what you would have is an agency record, right? That's normally how a certiorari appeal, that's where the findings happen, and that record comes before you, and that's what you review. I mean, this is no different. State agencies do licensing decisions all the time, every day, and those are reviewed by certiorari. And so I think the difficulty you're struggling with is that the legislature essentially didn't provide a process that creates the typical administrative record before this comes to you. But they did not create a district court right of review either. And that's what would be necessary in order for this to go to the district court.
And why would the litigants be deprived of an opportunity of pursuing a DEC action in district court to say, well, you know, what's going on here?
is noncompliant, and let's develop that record on a more global basis, which is part of the claims that I see among the four.
Yeah, and I will dig out for you the quotes when I get up on reply. But I think we've got authority cited that I will point you to that say that, you know, deck actions, while a deck action is a mechanism, it doesn't create sort of the underlying substantive rights. And so if there's a writ of certiorari right available, that is the available deck action, doesn't take that away. So you can't proceed by deck action instead of writ of certiorari where you've got the writ available.
Distinguish, how does, because at least one of the complaints raised procedural due process as a count or basis for their challenge. How does that compare with, for example, relative to the question that we're talking about, the equal protection argument since waiver, which could proceed in district court? What do you do with procedural? And they had a substantive due process. I'm not sure what that is, but I'll focus on procedural.
I mean, I guess, you know, and I will be honest, I fundamentally just, the district court did not determine that these were its bases. The district court did not sit here and say, it's mandamus, it's constitutional, I have a basis. The district court said,
I appreciate that, but we're looking at your request for a writ of prohibition that you want to establish is because there's a lack of jurisdiction. So we're looking at the argument of, is there a lack of subject matter jurisdiction, no matter what the district court? I think that we're reviewing that without respect to what the district court said. And that's what we asked for briefing on. So I'm trying to distinguish, and I appreciate these things are difficult, you know, figuring out what's waiver in a given case, what goes where and stuff. But I'm trying to understand the difference between procedural due process and equal protection vis-a-vis this question of who gets it.
Yeah, no, and I do understand the question. I come back to the point I made before. The relief being sought here was we should be deemed qualified applicants. And I point to the district court's decision because typically this court's review is limited to what the district court considered. And here the district court not only said, I'll issue the stay, but go to the Court of Appeals. And when parties went back and said, should we continue other proceedings here? The district court said, no, I'm not doing that. And so we have a district court that is disavowing jurisdiction. We have a stay that nobody's challenging. the OCM hasn't appealed. We aren't a party to. And that stay is preventing qualified applicants from seeking relief to go and get this lottery run because they've been severely prejudiced by this. And so this, you know, at the end of the day, the district court simply hasn't said, I have jurisdiction. The district court hit a pause button and then said, go to the Court of Appeals, and we're not going to proceed here in the meantime. And
on the mandamus proceeding, too, you're not proceeding?
Correct. Correct. I'm not a part of that case, but he did issue an order to the party saying that he would not proceed on parallel proceedings while this was at the Court of Appeals. And so there is no other venue to seek this relief.
Does that mean that the district court, and whether it does or not, I'm not sure matters to us, but that the district court believes that it lacks jurisdiction on that part of the case that might otherwise be in front of it? I circle back again to, let's pretend for a moment it's going to decide procedural due process. Would that be wrong? Is that exclusive cert jurisdiction over a procedural due process claim?
And I apologize. What I'm going to do is sit down and look at those claims specifically so that I can answer that with, I don't want to sort of give you a junky answer right now. So let me look at those specifically and see how they're formed so that I can give you a better answer to that.
I think that's Greenleaf.
Yeah.
Someone else might do it too, but Greenleaf does.
But it looks like my time is up for now.
Wild Domain also has got claims related to process and equal protection.
So okay. I will look at those specifically so I can respond to them on reply.
Thank you very much. Council, we'll give you a little extra time in light of the fact that we started late on the timeline. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Emily Anderson, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the Office of Cannabis Management and its Interim Director, Eric Tobel. Again, I'm going to agree with my colleague on the other side here. We have a lot of agreement in this case, and I think the fundamental thing that all the parties to this who have appeared today and who submitted briefing to you agree on, that this court should decide the issue of the district court's subject matter jurisdiction over specifically OCM's licensing decisions. And that, we think, is the merits of the writ of prohibition. So OCM believes that even though this specific writ is moot, that legal issue that is implicated by the writ is still very much alive. Right now, there is no order from any court telling disappointed applicants where to go with their problems about those decisions in this specific context. And that narrow legal issue is easy for this court to decide. There's a whole line of Supreme Court precedent that this new context slots into. You can apply that precedent, you can apply that line of precedent, and provide clarity to OCM, to applicants, to lower courts going forward.
Doesn't it really depend on the claim that is brought?
Sure.
The same as an employment claim, yeah. Might or might not belong in district court.
Sure. And, of course, I was taking notes and prepared to address that. I read Zweber more like you do, but the way I read Zweber is that whatever the name of the claim, whatever somebody calls it, whether they call it a procedure or due process claim, whether they call it a writ of mandamus, whether they call it an equal protection claim, you have to go to sort of the heart of the claim. Is what's at issue the validity of the quasi-judicial decision? And I think the procedural due process claims, the equal protection claims that were raised by Wild Domain and Greenleaf and those other folks, I agree with my colleague, at bottom, whether you are entitled to a deficiency notice, whether the legislature validly abrogated judicial review of those decisions, it depends on whether or not OCM made the right decision in the first place on whether or not your application should be denied or granted.
Is that so? Oh, yeah.
What if there was a procedural problem and now what they say is review my application, re-review it in light of with the correct procedure, and if it turns out you rule against us, well, then I know I have a cert review.
So I don't think that that's what the specific procedural due process claims here were asking. I think that they were saying, because you deny or because you didn't review X, Y, Z, we're entitled to a deficiency notice. And that, again, depends on whether or not OCM reviewed for the right things. Essentially, all those decisions kind of on the flow chart, you have to start with, were we correctly denied or not? And then what process you get flows down from that decision. I think under Zweber, that means you can raise it and need to raise it in a cert petition.
I'm not convinced that we're so certain that that the denials were just narrowly tailored to each individual applicant. I mean, the way that I read some of the complaints in this case are that the office was engaged in a process that was defective, and that defective process extends. It does impact these four applicants, but it also impacts other applicants who may be aggrieved by this process, which puts us in legislative land and not quasi-judicial land. And, you know, this sort of dovetails into my second concern, and that is, how are we, as the Court of Appeals, with limited functions and limited abilities to assess the true nature of these claims when we are ill-equipped to do so?
So I'd give you two answers for that. The first of which is that all four of those respondents are respondents in this case. To the extent that they think that they have procedural due process claims that are separate and apart from the validity of their denials, they sort of forfeited those arguments by failing to make them at any point. They knew what OCM's arguments were. They knew what petitioner's arguments were. They didn't make them. They were respondents to this case.
What do you mean they didn't make them?
They were respondents to this petition. I think OCM was very clear, the petitioners were clear that we thought that this was quasi-judicial, had to be reviewed by cert. They didn't...
Don't we review subject matter jurisdiction questions de novo?
Sure, but to the extent that there is lack of a record, it is because respondents didn't want to give you that record, the denied applicant respondents. And in a cert appeal, again, to the extent that they raise these properly, we think, via cert appeal, you do get an agency record. You would get to see how OCM made the decisions, sort of what their process was, and you would get to review it. It's not, you know, cert appeals, I've defended procedural due process claims in a cert appeal. They are the bread and butter when the sort of linchpin determination was, did you correctly deny my application or did you incorrectly deny the application? So I think as to those issues and to the extent you have concerns about the procedural due process and that sort of realm of things. I think, again, there is a narrow legal question that this court can answer, and that is on the validity of the licensing application decisions. Does a district court have subject matter jurisdiction? I think that that limited and narrow decision would be incredibly helpful for applicants, for OCM, and for the lower courts going forward. OCM's major concern here...
I mean, that's not really even an issue before us.
I think it is. That's pretty distinctly what the... we're calling the straw applicant or the denied straw applicants. That was the heart of their case, which was sort of the main vehicle that this came up. That was what they argued in response in this writ of prohibition matter, was whether or not the district court had jurisdiction to decide whether OCM should have granted their pre-approval or should have at least put them into the lottery. And whether or not they go into the lottery is whether or not those applications were correctly denied or should have been deemed qualified.
Have they now sought cert review?
Yes, the straw applicants do have two, or I'm calling them the straw applicants, Aranguiz and Connolly do have two cert petitions pending. OCM is defending those on the merits. They're pending before you. I don't believe oral argument has been scheduled, but I believe briefing is complete.
I think it's been set, counsel. Yeah.
I mean, so the question seems is there anything left for the district court? It's not whether there is some cert review of the validity of the decision. It seems like that process is off and going here.
I think for some applicants that is going. Mm-hmm. What OCM is seeking clarity on is clarifying, because again, we agree with the petitioners that the heart of the district court's decision here was pause the lottery while we figure out if Connolly and Aranguiz were correctly denied or not. Our concern is that we just closed another round of license applications. There are going to be decisions on those applications going out in the coming weeks. We are very worried about sort of resuming the chaos of last fall. There is no order from any court. The district court has not ordered. I agree with my colleagues that the district court certainly has indicated that he is concerned about his jurisdiction, but he has not ordered that he lacks jurisdiction. He has not dismissed any of the cases before him. And our concern is there are going to be application decisions coming out in the next couple weeks. I assume some of those are going to be denials. I assume some folks who get denied are going to be upset about that. OCM just does not want the chaos again.
Let's say that they go to district court then, and then they seek a temporary injunction, and, you know, we're in the same place. OCM can appeal that then.
OCM can appeal. Which
it did not do here.
Yes. Right? It did not, again, because the pre-approval process was supposed to be this very compressed thing that was supposed to happen before final rules were adopted, it was a practicality decision. We could either appeal and try to keep the pre-approval process on and perhaps end up delaying general licensing and taking longer before everyone can get their licenses and we get a legalized cannabis market going in Minnesota, or we cancel the pre-approval process, know that there's going to be some amount of harm, but then try to keep...
That's I think, maybe an extreme reading of what you could have done. I mean, isn't what the district court did here in grant injunctive relief?
Yes.
Okay. So if it granted injunctive relief, you could have immediately appealed, you could have asked for an expedited appeal, and then dealt with it that way. Yes?
I think, yes, certainly we could have. And I think on an expedited basis, though, we're likely still arguing around this time. But then we nominally have the pre-approval process still on the books, which means we're delaying sort of the subsequent rounds of licensing. The decision...
But if you appealed the district court's issuance of injunctive relief, you would get a decision on the merits as opposed to a question, you know, a decision on jurisdiction.
Certainly, yes.
You would have more certainty if you pursued the other route.
Well, I don't think I agree with more certainty, but I understand that is a route we could have taken. It was a decision on practicality in the moment to what we could do to try to keep the market going. Because we canceled the pre-approval process, we do agree that on its technical terms, this writ is moot. We think that, that's left to be decided. But because there are these sort of overriding jurisdictional concerns and these sort of overriding practicality concerns while we are here. You know, you have received briefing from competent counsel kind of representing all potential sides. The general license application is pretty much, well, not pretty much, it is identical to the pre-approval license application. The bases on which OCM reviews those applications are the same. The reasons that OCM can deny or approve those two different types of applications are the same. So that narrow issue of, after all that's done, and OCM makes a decision to deny you and you're upset about that, which court do you go to? That narrow legal issue, I think, is one that's sort of evergreen. And I do think this court's going to have to decide it eventually because there are going to be denials.
For sure. So what do you envision would be a prospective ruling by us? You know, you don't have to wordsmith it in a syllabus point, but what would we do that would be a forward-looking rule that would, like, set, you know, resolve it for all future cases? That seems a little bit challenging.
Yes, I am certainly not saying that there is not going to ever be continued litigation. I work for the state. There's kind of continued litigation about everything all the time. But I do think that you can provide a lot of clarity for folks. I don't think...
What would it be?
I think it's saying our temporary writ is formalized. The district court is not, you know, is prohibited from entering injunctions based on, you know, the validity of licensing decisions, and then spelling out that with respect to whether a denial of an application is valid or not, that is exclusively reviewable by certiorari under Zwaber, under DOCMO, under that sort of long line of Supreme Court precedent.
The rule of Zwaber.
It's repeating the rule, but
that applies to OCM
extending it to a new context, which is this court's bread and butter, right? Like, here's a rule, you know, OCM licensing didn't exist more than 2 years ago, so I get that there's a technical question because nobody's decided what happens with a cannabis application license. But it's a new context and an old rule. This court can say, as it does often, that like DHS licensing applications, like other agency application decisions, OCM is the same. You have to go by cert. And I think that that would just provide...
You have to go by cert if you're challenging the
validity. If you're challenging whether an application was correctly denied or should have been granted. I think that it can...
Is that the rule of Zwaber? I mean, that I think that changes the literal wording of Zwaber, which is not was it correctly denied or granted, but whether...
I think it's the validity of a quasi-judicial agency decision, although
right,
I don't have the case.
Validity, that is, whether the decision was unreasonable, arbitrary, or capricious.
Yes.
It doesn't say whether it followed, you know what I mean, whether it was discriminatory or followed, you know, like unfair, procedure, you know, didn't follow procedure this way. You know, that's where we're obviously trying to figure out what
yes.
are the limits to what you're saying.
Yes, and I think Zwaber acknowledged that line is not always particularly clear, but this court does hear procedural due process claims in the context of cert petitions, in the context of does a reconsideration process comport with procedural due process with respect to any application decision? I've defended that in a cert decision here. So I think the court can. As for, you know, obviously, I think what the court is correctly struggling with is that there are some sort of fringy claims in some of the respondents' complaints that were not litigated below, that have not been litigated up here. I think that you can leave those as to, like, for example, whether OCM or what is supposed to be contained in OCM's deficiency notice, for example. I think you can leave that question for another day and still provide a really useful ruling for everyone going forward to just sort of calm the waters.
But
if
a fringy claim in one of these underlying matters, which gave rise to the temporary injunction or stay order, is something that belongs in district court, well, then there's no basis for a writ of prohibition if the district court, in fact, had some jurisdiction, right?
I think if the court may used or if the basis of the court's jurisdiction or the basis of the court's order was that jurisdiction, then we could talk about it. But in that case, the injunction wouldn't match the prayer for relief. And I am fairly certain there's good case law that says that if the injunction that you're seeking doesn't match your claim, injunction isn't proper. So here,
If your issue...
Is that a jurisdictional question or just simply that the injunction was not properly entered?
I think...
I mean, we're here on a... Because of this odd arrangement, and I appreciate, do you mind if I go over a second?
No, yes, we need to get that.
I mean, we are not in the merits of, like, what doesn't match, you know, did the district court do a Dahlberg review, any of that. We're looking at, did the district court lack subject matter jurisdiction over this matter such that we have to do a writ of prohibition against its continued stay?
Sure.
And I'm concerned about the idea that there might be a kernel of some jurisdiction there that it's like, well, I'll put that aside for another day, because that seems to me exactly what we're here on, unless I'm misunderstanding.
I think, so my understanding of the writ of prohibition and sort of the underlying injunction here is that the injunction was not based on a process, give OCM time to send out deficiency notices. It was... Should this pre-approval lottery go forward because unqualified or because folks who should be qualified are being excluded? That is not a matter of deficiency. That is not a matter of notice. That isn't a matter of, you know, appeal rights. That is whether or not those folks had valid or whether the quasi-judicial decision was valid or not.
It seems to me, though, that on a writ of prohibition, our task is to determine whether the district court exceeded its authority, right? Or
yes,
acted in a way that it was prohibited from doing. And when I read Weber, it seems to me that our task is to extract all of the quasi-judicial decisions or potential quasi-judicial issues from the analysis and see what's left. And if the what's left... if the district court had any authority to act on the what's left, then it seems as though the writ should be denied. Why am I wrong, given the what Weber says? If resolution of the claim does not depend on the validity of the quasi-judicial decision, then the party may raise the claim by filing an action in district court.
I think I'm struggling a little here because I can't speak for the respondents who aren't here and aren't arguing.
I understand. It's a very odd procedural posture.
It is, and I understand it's probably not the most helpful for the court. My interpretation of those claims, which I did not bring them, so, you know, they are limited by my read of them. My read of them is that Wild Domain would not have been happy with a deficiency notice. That would not have solved their problem if they had just gotten the deficiency notice that, you know, their issue is they do not think that they were correctly excluded from the lottery.
From the panel. All right.
Thank you
very much.
Yes.
We're going to go back to 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll see how we do.
Yes.
All right?
That's fine.
I appreciate counsel's willingness to answer the court's questions. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Cool. No, and I appreciate the court's questions, and I appreciate that the court is tasked with this issue of trying to analyze the district court's jurisdiction on an unusual posture. I mean, I think one thing that the court is struggling with is that, you know, there's generally this doctrine that if an argument is not raised and presented, it is waived in the Court of Appeals. And what we're doing is talking about arguments that no party is making, right? This is not, the district court did not evaluate this basis, and there is no party in this case who's making an argument that there were legislative, essentially, claims under his waiver. And so...
Counsel, they don't couch the argument. And I'm making reference to the party that's not arguing today. I'm not quite sure how to say it. Arangiz, perhaps? And Connolly, all right, their brief. They're not here arguing. But they submitted a brief, and they do make the argument that one of the reasons that their application was denied came out as a result of this litigation. Again, it's OCM's decision, mm-hmm. and that process was defective, right? So, but they didn't learn about the defect until this litigation, the underlying litigation, and so that is what they claim they have a right to pursue.
Yeah.
Now, that's one argument, one of the respondents. There were other respondents that didn't submit separate briefs explaining, but of course we have their complaints, and this is a review of subject matter jurisdiction based on the allegations in those complaints, which, you know, given there have been no merits determinations, we're going to decide it as a question of law, right? So that gets back to my colleague's questions about what did those complaints assert, because you're now essentially saying that the district court had no authority to grant a stay as a result of those complaints.
And I do intend to answer that question. But I do think that this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court will frequently say, if there's no party carrying this forward and asking or suggesting that we should rule or consider certain questions, we won't.
But they are asking us. It's just they're not arguing today, counsel, but they filed a brief asking us to deny the writ.
And they did so on the basis that of a writ of mandamus. And we've put in our brief a rebuttal for why a writ of mandamus was not available. And in fact, that party had not even pled a claim for writ of mandamus in the district.
I mean, this is also different because we're talking about whether a district court has exceeded or done something that it is not permitted to do.
Yeah.
So oftentimes you're not going to, I mean, the district court can't come here and defend itself. So we're tasked with the responsibility of considering that as well. So yeah. I think an answer to
I absolutely intend to answer Judge Bradfield's question. So I've walked through the different claims. I'm going to walk through them here, but as I go through them and ask, is the inquiry essentially into the validity of a quasi-judicial decision, I come over and over again to the fact that it is. So, for example, in Greenleaf, the substantive due process claim was that they had a property interest in the pre-approval lottery. And I will tell you there's fairly black-letter law in the state about property interests in licenses, and there isn't one. But regardless, they had a substantive due process claim that there was no basis to deny their pre-approval application.
Well, I mean, they also state that OCM disregarded the statutory requirements for pre-approving social equity applicants, which seems to be a process issue.
But I think they're saying as to us. Right? So we are questioning the application, the validity of the application of the law to our submission. I mean, they don't have insight or knowledge about other applicants. Their claims are as to them.
Discovery's for.
I get that. I understand what you're arguing about that. That's like they're complaining that you applied it to us wrongly.
Correct.
Look at the evidence. You know, well, correct. You know, that's like, you know, looking at the validity. I've had cases that, you know, in previous work that involved due process as part of cert review. But I just do have I struggle with this one because if someone raises a procedural due process, it's like you say, oh, there is no property interest. Hey, where do you litigate that? At the district court. You failed to assert, you know, it's a Rule 12 motion, right? You don't have a property interest. But it's not, doesn't necessarily, does it convert it all the time into a cert exclusive jurisdictional matter?
I don't know that it does all the time. I think it does in this case.
Okay,
because I think that
going.
What these individuals were after was a challenge of their applications. And when we look at, was it Wildleaf? Is that right?
Wild Domain?
Wild Domain, thank you. I apologize. We were not parties to the underlying proceeding. Wild Domain, again, you know, you've got alleged deficiencies as to their notice, their right to be heard. Those, again, go to the validity of the quasi-judicial process. You've got an equal protection claim that actually says others received notice and we did not. So that goes, again, that sort of counteracts that legislative idea of it being broad. They're saying we were actually treated differently, and that's our equal protection claim.
Why doesn't that belong in district court under Zweber?
So I think that highlights the idea that their claim is that our quasi-judicial, our process, our review of our application is what we're challenging. So we're not challenging how everybody else's was because other people got this process. We're challenging ours. And so, again, in the context of a licensing decision, I think that inherently is an inquiry into the validity of the quasi-judicial process.
The real challenge of this case is that there are clearly some portions of each of these four complaints that are unique and apply only to the decision with respect to the applicants.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also broader issues. And so I'm wondering if this is a wholesale issue. If this is a wholesale, they're either is subject matter jurisdiction over everything, or there's subject matter jurisdiction over nothing? Or why can't we say that there's a kernel of subject matter jurisdiction,
a la Zweber, and therefore the district court acts within its authority to fashion relief that it determines is appropriate.
I think that while there theoretically could be, I just don't think the court or the record before you suggests that was the basis for the decision. Mm-hmm. And I think fundamentally, I mean, part of why you don't have respondents here is because they don't continue to have an ongoing interest in pursuing this. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a stay that there's no way for our clients to challenge. We are trying to figure, you know, none of the people who actually sought it now want it. They're not here arguing for it. And we've got a court itself who's like, I don't know if I have jurisdiction or not. You know, this seems like a situation where and his stay is in place until there's an order of the Court of Appeals that says otherwise. This is the only vehicle by which that happens.
And if I may, I realize we're over time, but so if you'd address the argument that you did have an opportunity, because it was made in the briefing, that your client could have intervened in district court. I appreciate you weren't a party to the four complaints that we're talking about today, but you could have intervened, right?
Well, logistically, I don't know that we could have, right?
Why?
Because this complaint was filed 4 days before the hearing and the order issued. Our clients weren't on notice. They weren't served. They received notice when the lottery was canceled. Once the order issued, the court had instructed everybody to go to the Court of Appeals and questioned its own jurisdiction. I don't know that intervening after an order issued would be timely. And fundamentally...
Well, the district court action hasn't ended. You know, the court's order was... It was a very complete stay order, but there are many cases in which if the district court hasn't granted judgment, the action's still there. I mean, the district court may have told you it did not want to hear an intervention order. That would have been or an intervention motion. That would have given you a right to appeal that decision, I believe.
And the other authority that I'd point you to is this court's line of authority related to, I think, State v. Turner is an example of a case that we cited. But
that's a criminal case?
That particular one is a criminal case. That was a criminal defendant was seeking
You can intervene on appeal, counsel. It's like you can intervene in someone else's appeal. Request may not be granted. You obviously have to make a showing. But I'm just skeptical of your argument that you could not intervene.
We did not see intervention as available. I mean, their appeals, we don't have a fundamental interest in their appeals. Our clients they're qualified. They just want the lottery to proceed.
Stay order. That's why I'm wondering why you did not pursue a district court option to say something like this is prejudicing us. Couldn't there be an exception? I don't know what your argument would have been.
I think that intervening after an issue is ordered, asking for reconsideration when they have put it to the Court of Appeals, the very decision that's been made. I don't know that the district court would think it had jurisdiction at that point to continue to consider the issue. They have said until an order of the Court of Appeals issues, this stay will be in place. And a number of cases, State v. Turner is one of them. We also cited one of the press cases, and I'll find it for you here. I think Minneapolis Star and Tribune is another case where the court has recognized that. You know, here we had a very, very shortened time frame, right? For pre-approval to happen, it needs to happen before the general lottery, or it's essentially the relief that can be sought. It just kind of dissipates. It's no longer there. And we had a very short time period to do that, about 6 months. And the idea of going through a district court, trying to appeal, trying to go through a regular full court appellate process, all of those processes are too long. Even if we had been able to do it, and I question whether we would have been successful. And so a writ of prohibition to this court was, I think, the only adequate remedy available to our clients. Okay.
Go ahead. Yes, of course. Of course.
Different. I'm sorry to keep you. If we were to deny the writ, it affects your clients because why? In light of OCM's decision, just... spell it out for me.
Yeah. So we have brought a writ of mandamus.
It's only if you succeed in those writs that you're effective.
Correct. So okay. We brought a writ of mandamus, and that it is our position that OCM actually has a statutory obligation to run the pre-approval lottery once it started it.
And so the idea is if the district court can't order mandamus if this stay is in place, I mean, wouldn't it just necessarily resolve itself in district court? Oh, no, they do have to order it. I'm lifting the stay and ordering it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess our concern is that if the stay is out there and it's, as the court sees it, put to the Court of Appeals to decide whether or not this lottery should proceed or not, that whether or not they have to run it, we're going to just end up with OCM saying, well, we're still stayed.
And it'll delay that decision.
Yes, and so then we'll just be sort of kicking the can down the road. And
you still have an intervention right if we deny the writ. You could still intervene in the underlying district court action and attempt to pursue remedies in that fashion.
And if you deny the writ, that is what we will do. I assure you. But I do think this court has the ability to issue this relief. I do think that the questions raised by these particular applicants in this particular case was about whether it was a way to challenge their denials as qualified applicants. And I think that the relief we're asking for is both appropriate and within the scope of this court's authority.
I shouldn't have said you had a right of intervention. I said that you have an opportunity to.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, can I get that transcript?
Just to correct myself.
Thank you.
I express no opinion about the right of intervention.
Thank you.
Whether it exists or not. Counsel, thank you very much for your helpful arguments. We appreciate the complexity of the issue that you have presented to us and the situation that you are in. We will issue an opinion in the statutory time period. Thank you. We're in recess.
Please rise.